Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and tonight I have a really fun guest on. I've known him for a long, long time ago, but I haven't really connected with him until now. But he does something I'm kind of interested in, so let's bring him on. His name is Dale. So, Dale, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And, Dale, let's talk a little bit about you first, and then we're going to talk about what you do and why you start doing it.
Okay. Well, basically, I've been involved in ghost research since 1975. And basically, I started out, my interest goes all the way back to my childhood, pretty much. I guess my parents started me on this spooky hobby of mine when I was a youngster, kind of telling me ghost stories when I was young. And there were a lot of interesting ghost stories in the Chicagoland area. In fact, when my mom and dad were first dating back in the late 30s and early 1940s, one of my dad's favorite thing to do after a date was to ride around the cemetery in Chicago, very well known for a haunting, called Resurrection Cemetery, Resurrection Mary, looking for the ghost. And these are the kind of stories I kind of grew up with as a youngster. And later on, decided to look into some of these stories and tales that I'd heard as a youngster when I was an adolescent, and began to compile a lot of interesting material here in the Chicagoland area. I started out long before the World Wide Web and the Internet was what it is today, using just newspaper articles and little ads in newspapers, opening up a P.O. box in Oaklawn and telling people just to send me their ghost stories. And I was really quite amazed by the amount of material that was sent to me, what they would call snail mail today, through letters, descriptions and accounts of both public places and private places where people had experiences. And this was probably in the mid to late 1970s. And at that time, there was no ghost group or organization anywhere in the Midwest that was active to look into reports and accounts of ghost stories. So we decided to form a group, which was at one time just a loosely grouped bunch of people with like-minded interests, which was called the Ghost Trackers Club, which started back in 1977. And in the years through up to present, about 1982 or so, we decided to change it, the name of the group, to a bit more indicative of what we actually do, called Ghost Research Society, and it's been running ever since. So it's a very long, active group that we have about 25 active members here in the Chicagoland area and suburbs, which go along with me to investigate reports of ghosts, hauntings, poltergeist activity. We do have a website on the Internet now called the Ghost Research Society website at www.ghostresearch.org, and there's much information on the site about not only case histories, investigations we've done in the past, but other websites you can visit, a picture section that you can look at, which has, which I believe to be real, authentic photographs of ghosts and ones that have natural explanations. There's also information there about some of the tools of our trade, some of the information and equipment we actually do use in investigation and research. So we've kind of come a long way from just my parents telling me ghost stories to where I am today. I'm an author of four books now, and we also have our own publishing company called the Ghost Research Society Press. We've been publishing books now since 2004. We have 12 titles now in our publishing company. And we've just started our own production company for putting together movies and DVDs and documentaries.
That's very interesting. You know, I am a very firm believer that ghosts exist and have and will continue to exist. And other people, Dale, find it very hard to think that there could really be something known as a ghost. So when people call you and say, I think I have this strange thing going on in my house, what do you say to that person?
Well, usually when people first of all call me, maybe I should backtrack a little bit. When they first call me, they're usually experiencing something, and most people very often are not very good ghost hunters or investigators. Sometimes they jump to the conclusion that it might be something supernatural. We've been involved in a lot of cases, just conservatively speaking, several thousand cases, actually, that I've been involved with, not only here in the Chicagoland area, but out of state. I've actually been to England and Wales doing research out there twice. But in most cases, when people call me, it's simply that they're hearing sounds, they're feeling cold spots, they might get a whiff of something, it could be a very pleasant smell like perfume, it could be pipe tobacco, cigarette smoke, or something unusual. Sometimes they will actually see something, maybe out of the corner of their eye. They might have movements of objects. They might have unexplained shadows, bumps in the middle of the night, things of that nature. And people call me for usually one of two reasons. Either number one, to find out what's going on because they think they've lost their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they simply want somebody who can lend a gentle ear and won't laugh at them, won't make fun of them. Maybe some of they've told their stories to neighbors and friends and they say, well, you're crazy or you're just been working too hard or something of that nature or you're imagining it. Or that the other flip side of the coin is that they really believe there's something there, and they want to know what it is, and in some cases they want it to be removed. They want it out of there. Other times they might think that it might be a friend or a loved one that has passed on because of perhaps they've seen the image, and it looks like somebody that they knew in lifetime, or a certain smell or perfume or aftershave is something that that person wore while they were, you know, alive. And in that case, they just want to know that it's there. And in many cases, they don't, you know, they're fine kind of coexisting with the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm contacted by people that have problems, what I do is I go through a normal interview process and try to just let them tell me their story in their own words, what's been going on. Not actually asking a lot of questions. I don't want to kind of lead them into a certain avenue. Just kind of tell me what's been going on. And then at the end, I will ask questions to kind of firm up some points and details. And when that's done, basically we will normally set up a time to go into their home or their business or whatever it may be to bring along other people from our group to actually set up equipment and go through the building or the house and to look for anomalies through the different equipment that we do use. And it's quite scientific. The equipment we use actually has different purposes, but we've kind of adapted it for what we use it in ghost hunting. And we look for energy fields, electromagnetic deviations. We look for cold spots. We look for fluctuations of temperature, energy, light, things of that nature. And the people that are brought in with me, with my group, are not told in advance what's been going on at the place. So they come in basically ice cold, no knowledge of the phenomenon, except that they obviously know that they're going to a house that has some activity. That's all they really know. And I consider it to be a lot more scientific because that way those people coming in have no preconceived notions of what's going on before they get there. They're not told that this happens in a certain room or this is what's been going on. And as they go through with the equipment, using maps that sometimes the clients will provide with us, they'll mark on the maps what they pick up with the equipment, what they might feel, hear, any sensations at all. And then we will sit down with the client, and even before the client informs the rest of the group what's been going on, our group will tell them what they've experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've actually, in the work I've been doing now for more than 30 years, about 80 to 85% of the time, my team could pretty much pick up the location, the room, part of the building where the phenomena takes place, and in many cases be very exact of what they felt, what they picked up, and if corner of the room or part of the bedroom or the basement or upstairs, they seem to nail it perfectly. Mm-hmm. And then the client will at that point tell our group what's been going on. And we will then set up equipment for a while to monitor different areas. And, of course, later we have to go through the videotape, the audio tape, still pictures, and find out and look for evidence of what's been going on. In some cases, we do come across some interesting photographs, interesting videotapes, and in some cases, audio tapes, looking for what's called EVP, or electronic voice phenomena, or even sometimes what I call ENP, or simply electronic noise phenomena, just strange sounds or bumps that were not heard at the time, but were recorded on the tape.
It's really funny because every place I have lived, there's a ghost. So do ghosts tend to follow people from place to place?
Well, there's ghosts can be, I believe ghosts can be, there's haunted houses, there's haunted people, there are actually haunted antiques, family heirlooms. I've read a lot of material about that. I actually have kind of inherited some haunted antiques myself. Mm-hmm. But I also believe, too, when you say you go to a lot of places and ghosts are there all around, I find that sometimes people that are very open-minded, are very intuitive, they are the people that are going to have the experiences more so than skeptics, the people that have a closed mind, or people that try to brush this off as something else. It's not a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
So we always approach everything with a bit of skepticism, but an open mind, because I can't always jump to the conclusion it's a ghost. But in cases of homes that are haunted, the home can be haunted but simply by a person that lived there in the past that for some reason doesn't want to let go of physical life and just mm-hmm. had enjoyed living there so long that the essence of that person is still there, can be perceived through a variety of senses. Sometimes a person can actually be followed around by a ghost, and that can be one of two things, either that the ghost is a friend or a loved one or somebody that they knew in lifetime that is following them around, or perhaps a total stranger that the person reminds the ghost of somebody that he or she knew while they were alive. And it's just maybe an uncanny resemblance to somebody that they knew. And in the case of haunted antiques, we do know that a lot of items that hold sentimental value, including family heirlooms, pieces of jewelry, gold watches, bureaus, rocking chairs. There's even been a set of bunk beds a number of years ago in Horicon, Wisconsin, that were purchased from an antique dealer, where family had a lot of activity going on in their home until they finally got rid of those bunk beds. These items can, in fact, hold on to the impressions of people that own them. And in some cases, the resulting phenomenon can be, in some cases, nice, and in some cases, very disturbing.
The houses and places that you have been, have you noticed that people use Ouija boards in them or have had something to do with Ouija boards?
That's one of the questions that's on our brochure that when we do it through the interview process. After people tell me everything that has been happening in their home, I go through and kind of fill in the blanks at the end. And one of the questions I ask is, has there ever been anybody using Ouija boards, seances, automatic writing, just delving in the black arts, any type of, you know, kind of communication like that, even you know, trying to communicate using EVP, just kind of opening doorways that way. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times there is activity, not only because, sometimes not because of the people that are living there presently, but of previous owners and occupants that, in fact, were involved in the use of Ouija boards, seances, or automatic writing, or things of that nature, that have kind of opened up these doors to the other side. And in many cases, they don't close those doors properly, and these entities or whatever just kind of hang around for a bit, and they can be troublesome. We have a text file on my website about the dangers of using Ouija boards. There was an excellent book written a number of years ago by a man named Stoker Hunt, who I had a chance to meet in Chicago about 10 years ago called Ouija, Most Dangerous Game.
Mm-hmm.
And he went into both the what he believed to be negative and positive aspects of the Ouija board, but the negative aspects outweigh the positive aspects by quite a bit. When you're using an Ouija board, pretty much, it's I like to paraphrase it as saying you're picking up a telephone, you're dialing a number with your eyes closed, so you don't know who you're going to get on the line, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like kind of opening up a communication to whatever ghost or entity might be hanging around, kind of inviting them in. And what often happens is sometimes they carry the seance or the Ouija board session a bit too far, is when they actually ask for the ghost or whoever they're communicating with to move an object, come here, do something, kind of sort of like inviting them in. And that's where the danger really kind of lies in, because you're kind of like basically inviting the ghost to come and be a part of your lifetime for a while. And in many cases, these things can be a bit troublesome. I've heard of some pretty bizarre cases that people have called me on, and we don't accept every single case that we get, not only because I just get so many, but some do sound very negative, some negativity involved. And what I have to always look out for is the welfare of myself and my group that's being brought in to do an investigation, if they are going to be involved in any type of danger, physical harm, or anything of that nature, in locations where people have used seances, Ouija boards, or even practice satanic activity. So that occasionally does filter into some of the reports that we get from time to time. I would say approximately about 10% of the time or so, there is some sort of activity directly related to some sort of communication between spirits.
Yeah, there's a lot of people ask me about Ouija boards, and I tell them, please do yourself a favor and don't even get one, let alone bring it into your house or go do it with somebody else, especially if you really don't know what you're doing, because you could open doors that you're not going to close or you don't know how. And then a lot of things very seriously wrong could start happening, or things that you least expect could be going on.
Yeah, the Ouija board basically is just a piece of compressed wood. It's really the type of communication that you're trying to get. You don't even have to use a Ouija board to communicate with spirits. I mean, you can use a seance, you can use a planchette on a piece of paper, which is called automatic writing, or other ways of communication, deep meditation, so forth, channeling, things of that nature. So you don't necessarily need a Ouija board. A Ouija board is just a tool or an instrument. But it comes into the same aspect as seances and so forth. You're trying to communicate with something that you don't know who that person is, unless you have a gifted psychic or clairvoyant that can discern who or what you are talking to. In our work, we never use these things. I do on occasion work with professional psychics that I've worked with for quite a number of years that are clairvoyant, psychically in tune in some way, and when we use them, again, they're brought in totally ice cold to places that we investigate and try to get a psychic aspect of what might be going on, and sometimes to try to communicate with the spirit, because especially in those cases where people simply say they cannot live with what's going on, and they really want somebody to get the ghost out. Well, I'm not a ghostbuster. I'm not a Dan Aykroyd or a Bill Murray. I don't have a way to simply store ghosts and get them out of homes. But we do work with professional psychics, which I believe can communicate with spirits, and in many cases simply convince the ghost that is there to leave, because many times, the scenario is that ghosts don't realize that they have passed on because of the way they died, suddenly, untimely, or traumatically. And that's the most often repeated scenario that I've found in homes, businesses, and places that are haunted, is some form of untimely death. Now, people die in homes all the time. People die in hospitals all the time, and those hospitals and homes are not always haunted. It's sometimes simply the way people die. If they're not, if it was an accident, something very sudden or very violent, those are the types of scenarios where ghostly activity can later come into play.
The ghost things that you have checked out, Dale, are any of them ever evil type ghost? Are most of them just, you know, not knowing that they've already passed over?
Well, the ones that I've investigated here in the Chicagoland area, and there are many, many public sites in the Chicagoland area. I've written two books, Windy City Ghosts and Windy City Ghosts 2, and it really only those two books only touch the tip of the iceberg in the Chicagoland area. There are more than 180 such public sites that I know of right now, and I'm adding almost a site every week or so that I come across that the public can actually visit where there is some activity still going on today. And these are places like businesses, restaurants, bowling alleys, churches, taverns and pubs, sacred sites, murder locations that are all public places. And what happens in many of these instances here in the Chicagoland area, we've kind of broken down ghosts into two main categories, what's called the residual haunting and the apparition. Now, what we come across most often is this residual haunting effect, and it's simply, again, because of the way a person has died, a particularly tragic, violent death, and there are many examples in the Chicagoland area. People that experience the haunting or the ghost often see the ghost as a replay of an event that took place back in time. That person's death scene, the death scenario, the ghost kind of reliving their death over and over again, like just playing a videotape or a DVD over and over again in a player. And there's no real intelligence involved with that. It's simply because of the event that took place there, it has sort of left an imprint, a psychic scar, if you will, in the fabric of time and space. And for some reason, under conditions we don't totally understand, these things can replay themselves back to people, and sometimes people get very vivid apparitions and sightings of what they believe to be real people taking place, some scene replaying. Police are sometimes even called to investigate because it looks like a crime scene or a crime taking place and there's nothing going on there. That's what most people experience when they experience a ghost. However, the flip side of the coin is that apparition, where you actually have communication between the ghost and the living person. And this is an intelligent spirit, a surviving personality, if you will, that has not crossed over completely and literally interacts with people either a verbal or a nonverbal, telepathic or, you know, subconscious level of some kind. And there's actual communication taking place between the two, either a visual, that you see the ghost and the ghost sees you and recognizes that, you know, that there is some interaction there, or some sort of other verbal or nonverbal communication between the two. That's extremely rare, but we have come across instances in that here, not only in the Chicagoland area, but places across the country that I've investigated in my work. What is interesting in cases where people have these sightings, they'll in the case of the residual haunting, these may go on for months, they could go on for years, and continue the replay. Not any specific time, just when the energies are sufficient to produce the phenomena. When we go to investigate these locations and claims of sightings, most times things never happen to us when we're there because, again, the energies are not sufficient. But on occasion, we're able to come across activity going on in a home or business when we were there, and actually have gotten some evidence on videotape or audio tape or still photography.
Yeah, see, the ghost that is around me all the time calls my name. say, Nancy, and all I have to do is say, hi, how are you doing today? And it goes away.
Yeah.
So, and it happens, it doesn't matter what house I'm in. In fact, it's really funny, when I was living with my boyfriend, I said to him, I said, you know, there's a ghost here. And he goes, yeah. Okay. And then his son came over for a weekend, and we were sitting on the couch. My boyfriend and myself were sitting on the couch, and his son was actually in his bedroom. And all of a sudden, his son comes running out of the bedroom going, Dad, what did you want? Now, my boyfriend had not said a word, but I had told him that, you know, the ghost calls people's names. And he looked at us and goes, I didn't call you. Now, I'm sitting on the couch ready to just burst out laughing because I already know what's going on, but I have to be real straight with the whole thing. And son says, yeah, Dad, you just called me. He goes, no, I didn't call you. And the son goes, well, okay. And it goes back into the bedroom. So, I mean, it's not that it just calls my name. It does call out other people's names that are in the same house I'm in, you know, which shows me that there's something there. And I'm not afraid of it. I just say, hi, how are you? And it usually just, you know, as long as I acknowledge it, you know, goes away. So yeah. What kind would that be?
Well, in the work that we do, we do try to tape sessions where if there is nothing going on for a while, we sit there for an hour or two and nothing is apparently going on. We will actually send people into certain areas of the building and to try to tape EVP sessions where they might ask a question. Then you leave a 20 seconds or so of blank tape for the reply. You ask another question, so forth and so on, and you leave some blank tape after each question. The theory behind EVP is that you won't hear the sound or the voice as it's being recorded. It's only heard on the playback.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, if you're using audio tape, whether cassette tape or open reel tapes, they're magnetic recording tape, and ghosts are electromagnetic frequencies. They do have an energy. The theory is it bypasses the physical microphone and is actually imprinted directly onto the magnetic recording tape. Therefore, you would not hear the sounds until they are played back later. And in many cases, we've been doing some experimenting with this new recording device, which I'll be getting a prototype here in just a few months, called the Box. It's called Frank's Box. It's a brand new thing we're going to be working on, another form of communication device. And we did tape a session recently at the Lincoln Theater in Decatur, Illinois, which is a very haunted place. They have a conference every year in June, put together by the American Ghost Society and Troy Taylor, which I'll be doing a talk down there this June, doing a workshop on ghost hunting techniques to promote my new book that's coming out called A Field Guide to Ghost Hunting Techniques. We were doing an EVP session in there with this recording device, and when we played the tape back, it actually called one of my researchers by name. Mm-hmm. Not Joe, but Joey, and that's what he's known as.
Mm-hmm.
And and then when he said, do you mean the Joey that's with the group? And then, of course, they didn't hear the sound until they played it back. And the voice said, yes, that one. So it was like it was definitely, first of all, identified the person by name, but then it actually verified that it was the person in the group that he was talking to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they can call you by name. I know I worked for a number of years with a very gifted researcher, Sarah Estep, from the American Association for EVP, Electronic Voice Phenomena, when she was a pioneer in recording spirit voices. And many of the spirit voices actually called her by name. And she actually had what she would call drop-in ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
They would come at almost the same time every day, and she knew that she was talking to these ghosts that she had names for. And they talked with her and conversed with her on time. And very often identified her by name and answered specific questions that were posed to the ghosts. So, I mean, there is, I believe, some surviving energy, some surviving personality, if you will, that does survive the death of the body,
mm-hmm.
that can communicate with us. I'm sure you're familiar with the story of Harry Houdini and how he died and that he was supposed to come back to provide proof of his existence in the afterlife. And apparently, some say that he did. And there are other people, other researchers that were doing EVP sessions in the very early part of the 19th century, 20th century, where they actually were later conversing with people through these EVP sessions. So, again, the whole idea of people surviving the body, the death of the body, coming back in spirit form, is not as far-fetched as many people believe it. Skeptics, obviously, will always point out that there's always a answer for everything, and these are not ghosts at all, but it's just simply overactive imaginations or something else that's happening that needs to be repeated, studied, and under laboratory conditions, which it's just impossible to do because ghosts are very spontaneous.
Right. Now, why don't you give out your websites? Because you have more than one website, so why don't you give out all your website, all your information, so people could get a hold of you?
Well, the main website is www.ghostresearch.org, and that's the Ghost Research Society website. Now, within that website, there are other businesses within that website, which is on the main page. You can go to the various sites within that site. Which goes into both the publishing company site, which is the Ghost Research Society Press, which has the books we published. And we are always looking for new authors that are interested in getting their books published. And we do really good work. You can see the examples of the books on the website. And we have a number of authors we've already published for. We also have the sub website in there, also called Excursions into the Unknown, which are ghost tours that I've been doing here in the Chicagoland area since 1982. It was my idea to kind of put together kind of a spooky tour of sites around the Chicagoland area that we had researched and investigated to give the public a chance to actually visit these sites to experience, if you will, the ghostly aura of the place. And in some cases, people have in fact later either told me on the day or afterwards that they had either picked up something, felt something, saw something, and in many cases photographed things that later, when the film was developed, something showed up unusual on the film. And we do these ghost tours pretty much all year round. We have different size vehicles available for up to from 15 passenger vans up to large full-size coaches. We do private tours, group tours, and we do a lot of special theme tours for the spring and summer and early fall. And, of course, the Halloween tours are when most people want to go, is right around Halloween. We also have another section of the site, which we are going to be in the process of putting on right now, which is our production company, the GRS Productions, which we are putting together a series of documentaries called Ghosts Across America, filmed by Joey Tito, who was our videographer, and does a very nice job in editing the different pieces of videotape of locations that we've done work on all around the country. And we're going to have a series of these Ghosts Across America beginning as early as April of next year, putting these together and getting them on the website and to the general public.
That's kind of interesting. When you go out to people's homes or businesses or whatever, Dale, have you ever been out there and really had a very bad, bad feeling, or like a real eerie feeling of something there being quite evil?
Well, first I should probably say I've never really been spooked by a ghost so far, but there have been things that have happened that have been unexpected. When we talk and interview with people over the phone, this is all done by me, so I'm the only one that actually knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to keep it that way, as I mentioned earlier. But that's why I try to get all the relevant information in advance. So we kind of know what to expect when we get out there to a site. But on occasion, things are left out, perhaps by people, in talking, because I don't know the story myself. I'm trying to get it from the people verbatim. Or other things will happen that even were unexpected to the people themselves. And to give you a good example of this, we were out at a private home in the north side of Chicago, which was a subject of a Discovery Channel segment called Real Ghost Hunters that actually was filmed almost 10 years ago, back in 1999. Mm-hmm. And the woman that was living in the house had a number of strange things going on in the house, including things that she saw at the corner of her eye, lights flickering off and on, her animals reacting to strange things, because we know that animals can pick up, see, feel, or hear spirits. They're very sensitive. Their senses are much more sensitive than ours in many aspects. But the thing that really convinced her that something was really going on was one evening she woke up from a deep sleep, and leaning against her door jamb into her bedroom was a silhouette of a man dressed in a blue uniform. She winked a couple times, and it slowly began to fade away. She also said on several occasions something would grab her feet in the middle of the night and scream in her ear. Now, her husband thought she was simply going crazy because her husband never had any experiences, but he was not often there when these things were going on. He worked a different shift. And she called us in. We began going through an investigation of the home and were later contacted by the Discovery Channel, who wanted to see how we go about setting up our equipment and how we go through an investigation. They were not expecting anything to happen when they were there, and neither were we. But with the cameras rolling, things happened that we still cannot explain to this day. Most of the activity was in the upstairs rooms, which were completely sealed off. We had every single room monitored with night vision cameras, totally dark environment, nobody up there, and it was one way in and one way out from a long set of staircases. After about an hour and a half of nothing going on, suddenly we began to hear the distinct sound of footsteps walking across the floor upstairs. They were solid wood floors. You could actually hear shuffling of feet up there. We also began to hear sounds of things hitting the floor, metallic objects that were striking the floor, and the cameras showed nothing in any of the rooms that was going on. No movement, no nothing at all, just these sounds. Well, when the sounds finally stopped, I sent two of my researchers up there to look for a possible source of the explanation. And while they were up there, I said, actually in the documentary, move around the room and shuffle your feet. So we were actually able to compare the sounds of actual physical feet shuffling around, because we were recording these sounds with the tape recorders and so forth and video machines, to the actual ghostly sounds. And in using sophisticated computer software that I do use to analyze sounds and voices, the sounds are identical. The ghostly sounds and the real people walking around, the sounds were identical of shuffling of feet.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't expecting this to happen. So it kind of, you know, took us by surprise. But, of course, you know, the adrenaline was flowing a bit at the time. So I don't think we were scared. We were really intrigued by what was going on. But there have been some places we've been to that I've investigated where on occasion you kind of get the feeling you shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
You just kind of get a feeling of dread or anxiety. And not so much a dangerous feeling or a negative feeling, but just maybe you shouldn't be here at this time. Maybe you'd better come back in another day. And one such location is a very haunted cemetery on the south side of Chicago called Bachelor's Grove Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
I've investigated that. It's the thickest file I have in my folders right now. Been doing research in that cemetery for more than 30 years. And I've gotten so many reports of activity, apparitions, sounds, multiple witnesses to events that have taken place beginning about the 1960s and right up to present date of activity going on. And many times people have been back there and have gotten very strange, overpowering feelings of dread, and some people have actually gotten sick, physically sick, back there. Other times it seems very quiet. So there does seem to be something there, or something from the other side, if you will, that can physically affect the emotions and the well-being sometimes of people without actually creating physical harm. Just some sort of, perhaps it's the overabundance of negative energy or something else that can physically affect people and how they feel.
Do you think that there's more haunted places in England and Wales than there is here in the United States?
Well, England and Wales and places overseas have a much longer history than we have here in the United States. Some of the early settlers here, probably from the 1600s or so, go back to England, you go back to, you know, centuries beyond that. So the atmosphere and the area is much more vintaged than it is here, more aged, if you will. But I really believe in looking at places like England, London, and other places around the world, and comparing them to the sites that I know of here in the Chicagoland area, I would have to say my own personal belief is that Chicago may be the most haunted city anywhere. I've been to very, very haunted places around the country and around the world. I've been to London, England. I've been out to places in East Wales myself when I was out there. I've been out to Los Angeles, been out to New Orleans with the voodoo and so forth. I've actually been out to the sites of the World Trade Center soon after the 9/11 terrorist attacks out there. So I've been to a lot of places, Civil War battlefields, places where spook lights or ghost lights are sometimes seen. But my personal belief is that Chicago really may have more ghosts, more ghostly activity, more sights than perhaps any place I've ever researched, even though if you go by state-wise, as a state, California may have more hauntings. But Los Angeles falls way behind, even though it's the second largest city in the country, behind Chicago. And even New York City, which is the largest, does not have as many ghost stories here as Chicago does. And it has a lot to do with Chicago's history. If you go back through the violence that has taken place in Chicago since Chicago was incorporated back in 1834, there are a number of bizarre and untimely deaths, including the gang wars in the 1920s and 1930s, the Iroquois Theater fire in 1903 that killed some 620 people, the Eastland disaster in 1915 that killed 844 victims in the Chicago River, the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 that killed more than 300 people, the crash of Flight 191 at O'Hare Airport in 1979 that killed all 286 people. Our Lady of Angels fire in 1958 that killed 92 students and three nuns. The mass murders of John Wayne Gacy, Richard Speck, and the list goes on and on of places around the Chicagoland area where untimely and sometimes massive deaths have occurred, much more so than any other location that I'm aware of.
Yeah, and you're not counting the mob with what they've done.
Pardon?
I said, and you didn't count the mob with what they've done.
Exactly. And even today, drive-by shootings, you know, and so forth, and gang activity, yes. Violence is often directly associated with later ghostly activity because of the way people suddenly die. They're here one moment, they're gone the next. It's almost like the movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze, which I consider to be a perfect example of this. He was walking down the street with his girlfriend, Demi Moore. Patrick Swayze There was an altercation with a man trying to take his money. A struggle broke out. He chased this man down the street, trying to chase him. In spirit form, he had already died. He came back. He saw his dead body being held by his fiance. He thought he was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Just that spur of the moment, that quick, untimely death. And it's also been repeated in many other ghost stories and movies, such as White Noise, Shudder, Sixth Sense, the others, of people that believe they are still alive, practicing, in some cases like Bruce Willis in Sixth Sense, psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
Voice saying, I see dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, same scenario here, that untimely death leads to ghostly activity, and many times the ghosts that are there don't realize that they have passed on. They're continuing to do what they normally did in real life, or sometimes, in the case of a residual haunting, repeating that death scene or death scenario.
Hmm. What about when people maybe unknowingly build something or uproot a sacred ground? What happens there?
There are a lot of examples of that in Chicago. One good example is Archer Avenue. Archer Avenue was a pre-existing Indian trail that was first seen by Father Jacques Marquette and Louis Joliet in 1673 as they were trying to find a portage or a connection in between the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes. And they were coming down a river later named the Des Plaines River. They saw the area near St. James Sag, which is a church at 107th and Archer Avenue, and the old Indian trail heading down through the woods along the Des Plaines River, which later became Archer Avenue, named for Colonel William B. Archer. As Archer Avenue was paved over in 1836 to help facilitate the construction crew and workers who at that time were digging the Illinois-Michigan Canal, many Indian remains were disturbed on either side of the Indian Trail as it was paved over and widened. And that's why Archer Avenue, I believe, one of the reasons is that Archer Avenue is so haunted today, and there are more sites of ghostly activity along Archer than any other road anywhere in Chicago. There are many examples in Chicago of where bodies have been dug up accidentally during new construction.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these have been either part of the old city cemetery, which was at one time at Lincoln Park, part of the Lincoln Park Zoo, or pauper cemeteries, poor farms, that were simply forgotten about and were later, as human remains were dug up and they went back in the old history to the records and maps, they said, oh, yeah, there was an old cemetery here. There are no markers anymore, but these are the remains of these people. And in some cases where these remains have been disturbed, activity has happened at these sites for a period of time. And in some cases, it's still going on. Another good example is the Fort Dearborn Massacre, which took place in the War of 1812. Now, not more than a block away from where this battle took place, or massacre, if you really want to call it, was really not a battle at all, there were bodies unearthed or skeletal remains from possibly the War of 1812, dug up accidentally by streets and sanitation workers from the city of Chicago, and they were trying to fix some broken water pipes in the area, and they came across these skeletal remains. They first thought they were cholera victims from the 1833-1834 cholera epidemic, were thought to be even perhaps victims from the Great Chicago Fire, but the fire did not reach that far south. They were carbon dated more closely to the War of 1812, possibly victims from that massacre who were buried right where they fell and were never found until some 170 years later. And at that site, there has been a ghostly reenactment been seen almost from the day these bodies were unearthed right up to present time, of people seeing a reenactment of this battle taking place at that site near 16th in Indiana on the south side of the city. So, again, when we have remains of people sometimes disturbed, And that happens a lot at Bachelor's Grove, people going out there at all times of day and night, grave desecration. That's another reason that cemetery is so haunted. These things can, in fact, happen, I believe.
There's also a spot on Irving Park Road that is really pretty bad, and I can't remember exactly where it is, but my girlfriend used to live there, and it was by where they would make the cheesecakes.
Right.
And they started, and there was like an insane asylum there, and they actually tore down the insane asylum and rebuilt like a shopping mall on top of it.
Yeah, I believe it was the Dunning Plaza.
Yes.
There were, I have all the articles from that, with the medical examiner actually holding the remains of people in his hands, just bones, just charred bones pretty much. So, they look like they're charred, but they're really just kind of really old bones. And again, that was part of people that could not afford to be buried, or they might have been in state custody at that time in an insane asylum or been put away. And they were just buried, you know, either in a mass grave or just in simple, just little plots of land. And again, when that insane asylum, when it was torn down, you know, years and years, you know, decades ago, these records were simply lost. And there may not have, there may not have been any markers on the grave at all. Just plots of land designated where certain people were buried, and many of them were buried without any names.
Mm-hmm.
And later, when they were digging the foundation for these buildings, they came across all these people from the old insane asylum. Yeah. It happens a lot in Chicago. I have a whole file just on not only that, but even people moving into very old neighborhoods in Chicago, where before city ordinances were changed to prevent people from being buried in people's front or backyards,
mm-hmm.
People would be digging their, you know, maybe a swimming pool or maybe a rock garden or something in the back, and they'd come across remains of people. And in some cases, actually tombstones that are just covered with 3 or 4 inches of dirt that had fallen over, had been just, you know, dirt had been spilled over them through decades of neglect. And, of course, when they find bones, you know, they call the police. The police have to come out and investigate. And sure enough, they can trace it back to people that owned the property, you know, just decades ago. One of the stops on my tour that we take actually goes past a home, which we stop very, very briefly, that actually has two tombstones, two old limestone tombstones, clearly visible in the front yard of this house from people, again, that had lived there probably more than 80 years ago.
That's pretty scary.
It is.
Dale, could you give out your website and any information like for the listeners to have, please?
Sure. The website, again, is www.ghostresearch.org, and that's the main site. From there, you can access all the other sections of the website from the main page. You can actually sign up for a free online newsletter called The Ghostly Whisper. It's sent directly to your email about once a month. It's filled with articles, book reviews, lots of interesting stories, and a calendar of things that we are doing in Chicagoland area, including tours, lectures, workshops, and so forth. That's at the very bottom of the page. You can also look at the other sections of the website, and at the very bottom of the website, there's a little ghostly mailbox that you can click on as my direct email, which you can send me reports, pictures, or whatever, and we do analyze pictures that are sent to us, and give you my opinion, at least what I believe is in the picture, and that can be accessed directly at the very bottom of the site, ghostresearch.org.
Okay, cool. Now, you've written 2 books. Why don't you give those out again, and a third one coming?
Sure. The books I've written is Windy City Ghosts 1 and 2, A Field Guide to Spirit Photography, and Illuminating the Darkness, The Mystery of Spook Lights. The spirit photography one is a one that I put together to kind of show people how to better their chances of getting something on film, and what to do with the finished images once you get them, how to analyze them, how to use equipment with a photography to better your chances, and even if you don't have equipment or you don't have a psychic, to bring along an animal or a pet. And they're very often react to things in the environment, and you can snap pictures in that area where those animals react. My next book will be coming out in April, hopefully, maybe March, called The Field Guide to Ghost Hunting Techniques. And if you sign up for the Ghostly Whisper online newsletter, you'll get advance notice of that book coming out. And we will have limited edition copies of the original proof coming out probably in late March.
That's great. So all you listeners, if you got some ghost stories, make sure you send them off to Dale because he'd like to see them and hear them, right?
I definitely would. That's lots of the reports and lots of the stories that I have in my files right now have come directly from people that have sent reports either through email or later, earlier through letters. Sometimes I hear about them at lectures that I do, workshops, or even on ghost tours. So it's one way of getting a lot of good, useful information that can later research to find out there's really something to the story and find out if other people have also experienced it as well. So, yeah, I'm always interested in getting new reports or even reports of people that have had encounters at some of the sites that I've mentioned or maybe in my books that I already know about. I'm always interested in hearing other reports of stories and encounters, too.
Great. Dale, do you go out and, like, give lectures? Like, say somebody has a place, like down in Missouri, for example. My mom used to live in one of Jesse James' old house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's still ghosts there, and different things happen, although they've, you know, covered up a lot of the extra rooms that had trap doors to, and they really don't want anybody, you know, coming in there and doing any more stories about it. But do you do things like that? Like if somebody has something that's pretty noted, do you go out there and, you know, check in and do, like, lectures and stuff?
Yeah, I do both. We do investigations, and I do lectures. I've actually done lectures in haunted buildings and so forth. I've actually done radio shows and television shows in haunted studios where things have actually happened on live TV. A very short story, make a long story short, I was doing a show for a cable show and on a Continental Cablevision, and live TV with live call-ins and everything, no way to stop this, edit it out. We were talking about a ghost thing along St. Charles and Grace in the north side here, northwest side suburbs, and suddenly you hear a large piece of equipment somewhere fall in the background. It literally, you can see everybody on the studio and the set just simply jump. Because nothing, when we went to commercial break, they looked around, they couldn't find anything. It was a very small studio. Nothing had fallen over, but it was a very definite rattle of something going on in the background. So, yeah, these things can happen very often when you least expect them.
Which is neat. St. Charles and Grace, by the way, is only about a mile from where my office is at.
Yeah, that location is right along a set of railroad tracks there,
mm-hmm.
and it's right along St. Charles Road there, just before you get to Gray Street,
mm-hmm.
along the tree-lined pathway. There's been a report of a young boy that's been seen out there since the late 1980s or so, that in cars that are traveling 35, 40 miles an hour, he keeps up with the automobiles. He's able to keep up with the cars. And as people stop to look, he's sitting in the middle of the road. They start pulling away. He's starting to run with the car again. And then he suddenly disappears before he gets to the train track crossing.
I'll have to check that out.
It's a pretty bizarre story. I haven't been able to figure out what's been going on, but there were two reports that came through on that television show. And during the first report of that story, that's when that crash happened in the studio. So it was a bit unnerving.
It's kind of neat. Dale, our time is actually up. It's been very, very entertaining listening to you and a lot of fun because, like I said, I'm into the ghost scene anyway. But I would like to thank you for being on the show and sharing, you know, your information with myself and the listeners. I'm sure they all enjoyed it.
It's my pleasure.
And we'll talk, you know, again soon here because there's other questions I have for you, but we ran out of time here. But that's all right. I'll call you back, and not today, but later on this week, and I'll ask you some other things. So thanks for being on the show, Dale. It was very great.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You take care. Have a nice Christmas and holiday, okay? All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to thank you, the listeners. Hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. We're talking about my home territory, which is not doesn't happen very often because I usually have others, but this was great. Anyway, may God bless all of you. Have a great, great day. weekend and take care, and we'll talk to you later. Bye now.